Welcome back to Beretta.
That's right.
Is that what you were thinking it was?
A Quentin Martin production.
That's right. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable panel. It is Tuesday morning, and we are very glad you are with us. We always welcome you to join the conversation roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or our Facebook page or our tweet page.
Our tweet page.
Tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Our panel this morning, WAMC's Ray Graff and our guest, Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vielkind. Good morning, Jimmy.
Good morning, Joe.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, you know. I slept through the thunderstorms last night that rolled in, woke up and saw my phone say, you know, flash flood warning. But you know, it's been quite a couple weeks we've had here with this weather pattern.
It's a weird weather pattern, and now let's talk about your specialty, political weirdness. So, and let us begin with a subject we talked a little bit about yesterday, but I know it's a story you've been working very hard on. You have a piece this morning regarding Eliot Spitzer, the former governor of New York State, once again running for a political office in the state of New York.
He just couldn't stay away. So I think listeners probably know by now that Eliot Spitzer, the governor, the love gov, he of black sock fame, I'm sorry, Ray, are you all right?
As the New York Post had it yesterday, here we ho again.
Yeah, that's awful.
Here we ho again.
That's awful.
So Eliot Spitzer has begun petitioning to be a candidate for New York City comptroller. And until his announcement late Sunday evening and the media circus that accompanied it on yesterday, and will continue today and tomorrow and for probably a number of weeks, the only Democratic candidate for New York City comptroller was Scott Stringer, a former assemblyman, the Manhattan borough president, whose entry into that race essentially cleared the field, and who was all set to be coronated as comptroller with a sleepy election cycle. As one columnist put it this morning, he could have been forgiven for taking a week at the Cape in August until the events of Sunday. But here comes Eliot Spitzer, who is a man of a strong ego. I think people who have met him or seen him or been within about a 28-mile radius will acknowledge.
Self-assured.
And, yes, he is a self-assured man, and he has long dreamt of, thought about, hinted at the possibility of returning to some sort of public office.
Now, let me just stop you there because we have some clips. This was an interview that Alan did with Eliot Spitzer just however long ago was that? Was it late last year, I
October
believe.
October of 2012.
October of 2012. And this is cut 125. And this is Eliot Spitzer speaking to Alan about his future political plans.
Here's a good question. Will you run for office again?
I have been elected dog walker in my own house. So this is, you know, look, I thank you for the question to suggest it as possibilities. I love what I'm doing now. As Alan and I were talking a bit before the interview, I'm involved in a family business, which keeps me busy for a fair bit of the day. I have the TV show, and so I think I'm gainfully employed. I try to contribute through the media. The appeal of public office is real to anybody who's ever been there. Of course it's real. You like to think that you can contribute. Is it something I'm thinking about when I wake up in the morning? No. There are a lot of awfully good candidates out there. I'm beyond the stage where I think that I'm the only one who can do A, B, or C. There are a lot of folks who are talented, who are good, whom I support, and I think that we're being ably led and there'll be able candidates.
Now, with that said, given your preamble to what we just heard, how much of that do you believe is true in the sense of he feels, you know, that there are able candidates out in this particular job of controller in New York, but also the elephant in the room, which is how much of this is just being looked at as a stepping stone?
Well, so I was there when former Governor Spitzer said that to Alan Shartok at the event sponsored by the station. And the operative phrase that I heard him say was, the appeal of public life is real for, for anybody who's been there.
Yeah.
And I think the phrase that prompted me to shake my head no was, there are a lot of great candidates out there and I no longer feel the need to step forward. It's interesting. I spoke to several people yesterday about this idea of, why do these fallen politicians, disgraced, what have you, people like Anthony Weiner, Mark Sanford, now congressman, former governor of South Carolina, who admitted he absconded to Argentina with his mistress. I mean, how often do we even get to use the verb abscond related to any kind of political figure? But so Elliot Spitzer, I think that he had been thinking about this because, as people told me yesterday, you're infected by this. You are infected by this bug. And it is the same sensibility that drives a person who seeks the limelight of elected life to say, me, put me forward. I am the best one. I will lead you. Choose me. And especially when you've had success at that that activity, it does something to your psyche, and it's indicative of something in your psyche that you feel that you are the best and uniquely qualified person. And that is what Elliot Spitzer is saying now, that he feels that the office of comptroller could be creatively expanded, could be creatively tweaked, that through his management of some $150 billion of public pension funds, either as an activist shareholder, he could have some entry point into the conversation of financial regulation on Wall Street, which is what he has tailored himself as since leaving office. Now, the question is this just a stepping stone? This was a very logical step back into office. This was a race where he stands a decent shot of actual election. Is he going to rule out any run for anything in the future? Of course not. Would he be content to be the New York City comptroller for a couple of terms and then retire happily to wherever? Maybe, probably not. But I think it's a little bit too early to say whether this is a stepping stone.
It does sort of seem like the CEO of Macy's leaving and then coming back as the head shoe salesman.
Yeah, but if that CEO was shown the door for some various reasons which may not have been too pretty, then one who has ambition would say, well, okay, this is my way back
in. So I'll start in the mailroom again.
If I have to, I will. And I know how to get to the top. So,
But you look at a Sanford who sort of skipped those steps and said, all right, I'm going to go right into Congress.
Well, okay, but he was a governor, and now he's a congressman. Arguable demotion.
But he had options, right? I mean, he could have run for mayor of New York.
Elliot Spitzer.
Correct? Yes.
Well, yes. And so again, why did he choose this office? Well, there are a few. The knock on Elliot Spitzer is that his temperament was very well suited to be a prosecutor, that he was an aggressive person, that he was arguably an unhinged negotiator, and that when it was him versus X, be that the bad guys, he did very well and he fought. And he was good at that. But when he was the governor, he had trouble turning off that him versus X sensibility when, as we know, effective governing is often not bludgeoning the other side into submission, but...
Although that works too.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
But crafting a deal, negotiating, reaching some sort of settlement to which many people at the Capitol say his temperament was very ill-suited. It's interesting. I spoke to a man yesterday named Lloyd Constantine, who is a longtime Spitzer friend and confidant. He mentored Spitzer when he was a young prosecutor in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and eventually over the years became a friend and later an advisor in his gubernatorial administration. And the two, we should point out, have since grown apart. Constantine published a book titled Journal of the Plague Year, in which he laid out an account of the final days of the Spitzer administration that Spitzer disputed and was just frankly very unhappy that someone would sort of trade off of intimacy to write. But Constantine sort of laid out how he believes Spitzer would have succeeded as governor and had the skills to succeed, could have turned off that temperament had it not been for his, intramural sexual activities.
Yeah.
And the knowledge that at any time those activities could be exposed publicly, destroying him, his family, his administration. And so he says, with that behind him, he will arguably be successful in this new endeavor.
You know, what fascinates me, and I don't know if you have an answer to this, but take me inside the machine. There must be machine politics in the background of this. So who was it who said, well, look, you know, we know you have an inkling to move back into this. This is a good shot for you. So who in that New York City machine said, hey, we're giving you a green light on this?
I think nobody. I think it was the little voice in the back of Eliot Spitzer's
head.
So
nobody in the hierarchy, in the party, in New York said, okay, do what you got to do.
You have to remember, one of the reasons that the prostitution scandal proved to or prompted Governor Spitzer's resignation. I almost said proved fatal, but clearly, you know, it has not proven fatal.
Right.
But one of the reasons it prompted his resignation was he had burned bridges, not just to potential enemies, but to potential allies. Mm. Remember, he came in and he immediately picked a fight with Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver over the selection of a comptroller to replace Alan Hevesy. That Silver and the legislators selected Tom DiNapoli, then an assemblyman, to be the comptroller. And Spitzer raged and railed and even traveled to legislators' districts to denounce them. So he burned that bridge. He picked a fight with Joe Bruno over the budget, over various items. There was the revelations of the travel records scandal, sometimes known as Troopergate, looking at Bruno's use of state aircraft and whether Spitzer was involved in releasing those documents publicly. So he didn't have many friends at the time of these revelations. And I don't think he's done much to mend a lot of fences with the political class of New York State. You know, keep in mind, this Eliot Spitzer has been a media pundit, essentially, for the past several years. He has not served an elective life. He's not been on any boards. He's not really, any government boards.
Right. Lawyer and
precisely.
Commentator.
Precisely. And he's been managing his family business, which is a real estate management company in New York City.
And so forth.
Precisely. But he has not been mending fences in the way that, for example, our current governor, Andrew Cuomo, did after his unsuccessful bid for governor in 2002.
Against McCall. Yeah.
Precisely. So I don't think he got a green light. And if you look at where people have positioned themselves, all the chips have fallen on the side of Scott Stringer. Mm. Michael Mulgrew, the president of the United Federation of Teachers, a very potent political force in New York City elections, was quoted today in the Wall Street Journal saying he would do everything in his power to see to it that Scott Stringer is elected. If you look at the mayoral candidates, all of them, I believe Anthony Weiner is silent on the issue, but Christine Quinn, Bill de Blasio, they're all lining up on behalf of Scott Stringer. And part of that is that he does come through that machine system. And for lack of a better term, it is his turn.
So I have two questions. One, piggybacking on Ray's question about how much the party machinery got involved here. But if you're Scott Stringer, do you think he knew this was coming or did he read it in the paper?
I think he read it in the paper. From what I have heard, that there were very few people, if any, who were given a heads up about this. A lot of Spitzer's old friends and his former political team were not informed of this. He has a new political team. Two men who were former aides to Attorney General Schneiderman are supposedly going to run this campaign. I think Scott Stringer was taken by surprise, though I think that given the past statements about Spitzer, there have been reports over the past year, Eliot lusts to come back to public life.
Yeah.
And inevitably, you'd see either Spitzer or a spokesman say, that's malarkey. I don't lust for public life. But I think everyone knew this guy does. I think there was even a report at one point that he eyed this very office, New York City comptroller. So I think if you were Scott Stringer, you know, or someone on his team, you probably had a folder marked Plan D somewhere in the filing cabinet that said what to do if Eliot Spitzer dives into your race at the last minute.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back and continue our conversation before NPR News. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel. Jimmy Vielkind is here. Ray Graff. I'm Joe Donahue. We'll be back right after this short break.
Support for WMT comes from SPAC, presenting National Ballet of Canada July 16th through July 18th, presenting Emergence, The Four Seasons, and three performances of Giselle. This year, GE sponsors kids and Citizens Bank sponsors students. SPAC.org for tickets. Wiawaka, Lake George, New York, an enrichment and revitalization historic lakefront retreat created by and for women since 1903. WIAWAKA.org for events.
¶¶
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. We'll be going to NPR News in a moment. We have Jimmy Vielkind with us, the Times Union Capital reporter, and we've been discussing the reemergence politically of Eliot Spitzer. And you were talking about how everyone except for Anthony Weiner and the mayoral candidates in New York have come out in favor of Scott Stringer and have commented on this. Of course, everyone's waiting for the governor to comment.
Yes, and he's going to be in Buffalo this morning, I believe, doing an event about driver safety. So I know that our colleagues in the Buffalo media will be peppering him with questions on this, and I look forward to it. You can remember that Cuomo tries to keep this stuff as far away from him as possible. And I actually think that Eliot Spitzer's entry into this race is not good for Cuomo on the global macro level. Well, so let's just assume for a second that Andrew Cuomo might possibly have a national ambition to do something, you know, mm-hmm. to be the dog catcher of, you know, the United States or something of that nature. There might be offices that come available right. in the future. I don't know what they might be.
Yeah.
But let's make that assumption. So part of that narrative has to be I have taken the circus that is New York politics to you, voter in Iowa or Kansas or somewhere in middle America, where you have a very tangential and long view of those crazy people in the Empire State. And I have tamed it. I have made things right. If you have Eliot Spitzer elected as comptroller of the city of New York, if the voters of the state, the city of New York, take the Love Gov and put him in charge of the city pension funds, what do you think if you're that voter in Kansas?
Well, I guess. And if he comes in on top of that with
Mayor Anthony Weiner, the mayor who texted pictures of his crotch and the things below it to the world.
I see.
You only have a minute, right?
It's, you know, obviously it would be incumbent on the people of Kansas to know that New York City is not the same as New York State, but that's a tough argument to make.
Well, and that's the
thing. NPR doesn't know that. Why should people in Iowa know that?
Oh, that's nice. really nice. Well done.
If you think back at our national politics, the last person elected to the presidency from the state of New York was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The last person prior to him to try unsuccessfully was Al Smith. Yeah. And there are lots of reasons for that loss. But one of them was that Smith talked with the thickest New York accent you could imagine. And the radio was available for the first time. And people were just turned off.
So yeah.
I think it's bad for Cuomo on the macro level.
We're gonna take a break, and then we'll actually continue this conversation. Then we'll talk about other key issues in the news. Although, quite frankly, I could talk about this for the rest of the day. Absolutely. No,
then there's the third party candidate. Yeah, we
haven't even gotten to that wrinkle, as it were. Coming up next, we will continue our conversation after this break in NPR News. Again, you can get in on the conversation roundtable at wamc.org. Welcome back to the WAMC Roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue. WAMC's Ray Graff is here, and Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vielkind joins us. We welcome your comments always. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WAMC Roundtable, at WAMC Roundtable. We've been talking an awful lot this morning in our first part of our panel about the former governor of New York State, Eliot Spitzer, entering the political world once again and running for the office of controller in New York. And we've been talking a little bit about Scott Stringer and his entry in that race. But we had another candidate enter the race yesterday.
Yes, we do.
Yes, and we should note there is a Republican candidate,
yes.
John Burnett. I don't know much about him. I'm happy that I remembered his name. But, you know, with the registration advantage in New York City, the Democratic primary is often viewed as the de facto election.
Yep.
But you point out the delicious beauty of our electoral system where Kristen Davis, a former madam, a former alleged, she claims, purveyor of horizontal refreshment to our former governor, Eliot Spitzer.
Write that one down.
Supposedly, allegedly, claimedly going to run as the Libertarian candidate, which means, gloriously, that there will be debates featuring Eliot Spitzer and Manhattan Madam Kristen Davis.
I bet you anything in the world that doesn't happen.
No, you don't. But
I don't know. So Kristen Davis, listeners might recall, ran for governor in 2010.
Yes, she did.
And she...
The beds are too damn high party.
That's good.
Thank you very much.
she ran for governor unsuccessfully as a member of not the Libertarian Party, but she created her own party. It was a pro-marijuana legalization party.
Oh yeah.
And really, Ms. Davis is a savvy woman. And
so you're right on
no,
the high part.
She's a savvy woman, but she's really kind of behind the scenes being guided by this guy named Roger Stone, who in political circles is this sort of legendary...
Sorry, my microphone. This happens at... I should explain, Jimmy, that in public radio, occasionally microphones will fall off and things will break. So I'll just turn my mic up.
That was a great... that was one of those things that if we had...
Roger Stone is with us.
If we had replay on the webcam,
yeah.
There are high-strength rubber bands holding the microphone and that's so that when you move the microphone, like I'm tapping it right now, you don't get a lot of reverberation.
Right.
And all of a sudden, as Ray was talking, it just snapped
in
half.
If you recall, last time Jimmy was here, we had a little moth problem.
Yeah, that's right.
So anyway, continue. I'll turn my mic off for a moment and fix this.
We'll fix this.
So this guy Roger Stone is sort of this legendary political dirty trickster and something of a ragamuffin. You know, his claim to fame was that he had an affiliation with Richard Nixon way back in the day. He has a giant tattoo of the late president between his shoulder blades. He is a noted, avowed, and proud swinger. He's mostly a Florida resident, and he was involved with Carl Paladino's candidacy in 2010. He was involved with Kristen Davis. He was at one point hired by Joe Bruno to be an advisor, really to go after Spitzer. And he really just has this personal spot of unlove in his heart for Elliot Spitzer. So he somewhere, as one of my colleagues said on Twitter, is sipping an early afternoon martini, a gleam developing in his eye. And I wouldn't put it past him, Joe. He's smart. He's savvy. He knows the political system. And if anyone can get Kristen Davis onto the ballot to bird dog Spitzer, it's going to be him. So that's hilarious.
She's
no, I think that
though.
Could happen.
She's handled money, all these finances, and you know, she might have some
knows the good city
at keeping
like
multiple
nobody
sets
else.
Of books,
yeah,
right? You know,
exactly. Yeah.
Contacts on Wall Street.
But the question being, it would just seem to me, as you say, to dog him. But you know, it really doesn't need her to. This is going to dog him for the rest of his life.
It will be a tangible reminder to voters, as if as you rightly point out, as if they needed another tangible reminder. But it'll be a reminder at every turn that every time Elliot Spitzer starts to talk about his qualifications, starts to talk about his tenure. As Attorney General, starts to talk about the fact that he does have a deep record on financial regulation, on financial enforcement, and arguably has the qualifications to make a case to be comptroller. She'll be there to remind everybody, hookers, 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 hookers.
Can we roll that tape back later on all week long? Let's hear from Jimmy Vielkind.
Hookers, hookers, hookers. All right. So let us change the topic and talk a little bit about other issues happening in the state and the possibility of another session.
Well, yeah. And so Governor Cuomo in Herkimer this weekend raised the possibility of a special session related to flooding and to the devastation that has come to many Mohawk Valley communities as a result of just, you know, days upon days of torrential rains and then just regular rains at this point, with the ground saturated and people kind of struggling to put their lives back together. They're just getting socked again and again and again. So as governors do, immediately after this happened, he petitioned the federal government to declare a federal disaster, which will make communities eligible for a whole slew of aid programs sponsored and funded by the federal government. But that has yet to happen. I think it probably will, but we don't know. It's really in the hands of the federal government and
don't they usually
officials.
Eventually come through in some fashion?
Yeah, and I do see that happening. But the governor raised this possibility. He said, Well, if they don't, I will do everything in my power in the state to direct resources toward these communities. And if necessary, I will call the legislators back. Now, remember, they just left in late June. But he will call them back to the Capitol to appropriate money or take some action, what have you. And now, you know, this is interesting for a couple of reasons. So first of all, by saying as much, Governor Cuomo endears himself to the people of the Mohawk Valley who are struggling right now. And so any smart politician would be would not hesitate to say he or she would take every last full measure to support a stricken population.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, recall that legislators left town without acting on one of the key agenda items that the governor had advanced, this women's equality agenda. And what happened was the state assembly, dominated by Democrats, acted on all 10 points of the governor's agenda, including a controversial change to the state's abortion laws, in one omnibus bill.
Mm-hmm.
The state Senate rejected that abortion change, would not bring it to a vote on the floor, watched it fail as a hostile amendment to another bill, but acted individually on the 9 other planks of that agenda. But in New York, unlike in the federal Congress, we don't reconcile our legislation. So unless it's an exact match between both houses, you get bupkis. So Cuomo has been calling on members of the assembly to consider those 9 individual planks of the women's agenda. And if they happen to be in town, it's an excuse / opportunity for them to do so. So I think that it was interesting to me because literally just 2 weeks ago, the governor was saying there's no need for a special session. They just left 20 minutes ago. I think that's a direct quote. Now he's raising the possibility, and I already have heard talk of September, legislators returning in September. So it never ends.
No.
Okay, so I have two maybe not very naive questions, but does that mean then that to get the money rolling to help these storm-impacted areas that they're going to have to wait till September, or a special session? I mean, don't we have a mechanism in our state government to get things rolling for the people who need it prior to that?
Well, we have state programs, and we have money set aside for these kinds of things. But if you're talking about large-scale relief, you need an appropriation. You need a budget appropriation. To do that, you need an act of the state legislature. So,
It would seem like you'd want to get that moving.
Well, I raised September. That was the talk before the flood started.
Okay.
So this could speed things along.
Okay. So what else is going on? What else is exciting?
What else is exciting? Well, it is something of the slow season at the Capitol, but my colleague Jim Odato has been following a story that I think is it's interesting as someone who does his own taxes and files by paper, which I do.
You do?
I do.
What's wrong with you?
What is wrong?
I would be embarrassed to tell you how much I enjoy doing my taxes.
Really?
I really like it. But anyway, the tax department has subcontracted out the processing of many of its paper returns to a conglomerate called New York State Industries for the Disabled, which is a nonprofit group which is designed to steer contracts toward companies that can hire disabled New Yorkers to do certain tasks, in this case, process these paper tax returns. That conglomerate in turn subcontracted to, I believe, a Texas-based company called Source HOV, which it seems has severely bungled the handling of these paper returns. Now, the tax department has at first stonewalled the Times Union. They've stonewalled Jim in his attempts to find out about this. For months, they were insisting, oh, nothing is wrong, all is well, look over there. As we heard from readers and from people around the state, hey, it's been weeks, it's been months since I filed my paper return, I got no refund. We have since obtained memos from the tax department talking about retasking employees to deal with this.
Hmm.
We have learned that the tax department has retained KPMG, one of the big 4 accounting firms, a major auditor, a major financial help firm, to do something. We don't know. The tax department refuses to say what the parameters of KPMG's involvement are. It refuses to say how much KPMG is being paid and what KPMG has so far found. We know that there has been a 506% increase in overtime at the tax department between this year as they deal with the non-problem of these paper returns compared to last year. So something is going on, and every day Jim and my colleagues at the Times Union hear from more and more New Yorkers whose returns are in limbo. So I think that something is pretty severely wrong here, and we're still probing to find out exactly what.
Well, how many paper returns are there left? I mean, a lot. Speaking personally and from everybody I know, electronic filing. I mean, you just get on your computer, you put the program in, you're done, your check comes fast.
Right. Well, and the tax department really points out that I think somewhere in the high 90s of returns are on track, are being processed expeditiously, because at this point in our glorious digital age, most people do it electronically. But then you have, you have suckers like me who fill out the paper return.
Dinosaurs.
And frankly, it's because there is a fee for the software. There is a fee for either paying a preparer or buying the software if you don't qualify on certain income levels. If you are below a certain income threshold, you qualify for free assistance and free software. But not every New Yorker does. And what we've been hearing from a lot of the people who file these paper returns is that they refuse to pay for the privilege of paying their government. And so if there's no charge for the paper returns, and until the electronic system is free, they're going to file paper returns. And that's exactly my mindset. But you're right in that on the broad spectrum of returns, this is a small percentage. But it seems a fairly significant percentage of those paper returns are being delayed, stalled, or somehow otherwise tied up.
Well, if your number is correct, that it's a 516% increase in overtime, and the numbers continue to plummet on paper returns, then there clearly could be something amiss.
Something, I think it's clear to say that something is amiss. we've also heard just that the state, of course, if it doesn't pay your refund in a timely manner, is obligated to pay interest on said refund. And in one of the memos obtained by my colleague Jim Odato, the state has said that they expect to pay out this interest, and that they are even concerned that this might impact collections, because the employees of the tax department who are now dealing with this issue would otherwise be searching for revenue, searching for people who did not pay, searching for people who may have misreported things on their returns.
Interesting.
So this story has legs.
We are going to take a quick break. We'll be back and continue and wrap up our panel for this morning. Jimmy Vielkind joins us. He's Times Union Capital reporter. Ray Graff is here. We welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from the Westin Playhouse Theater Company, presenting the rock musical Next to Normal, starting July 11th, westinplayhouse.org for tickets. Express Pediatrics Highland, walk-in urgent care for children, specializing in summer trauma care, including fractures, rashes, wounds, asthma, sports injuries, and more, expresspediatrics.com. And Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees, offering daily specials, 518-432-0358.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue, along with Ray Graff and our guest Jimmy Vielkind, who is the Times Union Capital reporter. And we always welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WAMC Roundtable, WAMC Roundtable. I was reading in the paper this morning that Governor Pataki has changed lawyers, and I didn't realize that Governor Pataki was being sued.
Oh, this is big.
Well, this is something that I think dates from his administration. It was one of the tweaks he made to the way sex offenders are treated. I'm not too up on the details. Yeah, but it relates to post-release civil confinement.
And there were 10 of them, I think, right, that are suing at this point?
Yeah, and, of course, so government officials.
He's dropped the state attorney general.
Right. So government officials get sued.
Yeah.
This happens.
Yeah.
And the Attorney General's office has an entire division, the Division of State Counsel, that's job it is to defend, you know, the state against these lawsuits, which inevitably come. And so they, since Governor Pataki was acting in his capacity as a state officer, he was represented by the Attorney General's office. But according to an article in this morning's New York Times, this federal lawsuit, the defense that the state was putting forward for Governor Pataki in this suit was not the defense that he wanted to make. Essentially, he wanted to claim that he was acting on the advice of counsel and that he was doing this with input, and therefore it was not improper. And for whatever reason, the Attorney General's office would not advance that legal argument. They were advancing a different line of defense. And so Governor Pataki, upset, dropped the Attorney General's office and retained Abby Lowell, a well-known white-collar defense attorney at Pataki's own firm of Chadbourne and Park. And Lowell, listeners might remember, is known in the Capital Region for a defense of former Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno during right. his first federal corruption trial.
Now, does doing this, does switching away from the state then remove his blanket? In other words, I was acting in an official capacity, or is that still in place?
No, I think that the idea is in place. There's a question as to whether or not by not originally making that claim earlier in the trial, he can resurrect it now. And I'm not a lawyer. I haven't read through all the papers in the docket, so I don't quite know where that stands. It's not perfectly clear to me whether we taxpayers will be paying Mr. Lowell for his services.
Hmm.
And typically that is the case. Typically, again, as with Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, who's being sued for his handling of sexual harassment complaints that were proffered against some former Assemblyman Vito Lopez. Silver has chosen to retain an outside firm to represent him, I think at the cost of $500 an hour. And taxpayers are going to be liable for that. And he is not using the Attorney General's office because of a conflict, he says. The Attorney General's office is, I think, retained someone else who is named in the lawsuit.
According to the New York Times article, Abby Lowell in the filing to the judge said that the former governor had sought his services after being shocked to learn recently that the AG's office was, quote, not defending the case as he intended. The defense Mr. Pataki wanted to put forth, Mr. Lowell said, was that when he had his staff develop the so-called sexually violent predator initiative in 2005, he relied on the advice of his counsel and other senior staff members that the policy would withstand constitutional muster, as Mr. Pataki put it in a February 2010 deposition. But in May 2010, a lawyer in the office of the Attorney General at the time, Andrew Cuomo, told the judge in a court that the office would not raising an advice of counsel defense. So this all, and then he changes pretty much on the eve of the trial. So this has really been very drawn out.
Yes, as these things do. And frankly, it's been fairly below the radar. I was not aware or really following the lawsuit until, nor I think were most people until these revelations.
I know you had one other story you wanted to make mention of in our final 2 minutes.
Well, yes, there was actually a great report by my colleagues Alicia Santo and Scott Waldman in our Sunday paper about Camp Bisco. The music festival that is held every year in Mariahville. It's sort of an outdoor festival that draws some electronic music bands. I think that this year I forget who the big draw is going to be this year. I'm not cool enough to go to these kinds of festivals.
No, I mean clearly. Yeah.
Ray will be there. Ray's going to be the opening act.
That's me.
But there was a concern, and my colleagues interviewed a woman from Schenectady County, a young woman who's essentially paralyzed because she suffered a seizure at the concert last year, and it was very difficult for her to receive medical attention. So the article quoted officials at area hospitals, St. Mary's in Amsterdam, Ellis Hospital in Schenectady, questioning the preparations that the organizers of Camp Bisco make, and questioning the precautions that they take in case of medical emergencies. And it was interesting to note that this is held on private property. Security is performed by bikers, motorcycle guys, and police are not allowed on the property. So it was described in this article as something of an open-air drug market where people can get whatever whatever pleases them, be it a hallucinogen or a pill or whatever. And of course, you can bring in as much alcohol as you want, provided it comes in cans. So they really looked at this and questioned it. It certainly raised my eyebrows when I read it in the Sunday paper. And I think Scott and Alicia they did a fabulous job with it.
And so as of now, the show goes on July 11th through the 13th at the Indian Lookout Country Club just outside of Albany with the main performer, I believe, being the Disco Biscuits.
Oh, of course.
The Disco Biscuits.
The Disco Biscuits.
I'm sure that Hopper's used that as bumper music.
He says yes, yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. But it's quite a lineup. It's over 3 or 4 days. So, and a lot of the tickets sold out. So I don't, you know.
Well, yeah.
So we don't know like what you do now is just.
Well, I the show it
like
seems
increase
will
security
go on.
Increase.
Or just hope that those pesky kids go away. It's I think that mostly young people go to these concerts are going to go, and they're really probably not concerned about these kinds. These are not the kinds of things that a 20-something-year-old who wants to go for a nice weekend music concert is really concerned about. But I think a combination of the remote location, usually the high heat that happens this time of year, the possible drug use of concert goers, the probable alcohol use of concert goers, it sort of created this mix that. Perhaps warrants a few more precautions.
I mean, insurance. There has to be insurance, right? It's a private event for you're selling tickets. There has to be big insurance involved. Right?
I would assume so. It's actually not something I looked at. And the owner of the property has said that he takes the necessary precautions and feels that the systems that are in place are adequate to protect the health and safety of concert goers.
You can, we thank you very much. You can join us and comment on any of these issues that we've talked about by emailing us, roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Jimmy Vielkind is the Times Union Capital reporter. You can read his reporting at timesunion.com. Jimmy, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Raymond. Thank you very much.
Okay.
The Roundtable will continue on WAMC.